The early days of late night TV.
The people on the show were so smart and elegant and witty and urbane, and the audience was nicely dressed. Television in those days seemed much more important, much more glamorous, much more...
I think it was.
Yeah, was it really?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Do you know that they used to wear tuxedos in radio?
Back in the days of Jack Parr and Johnny Carson, The Tonight Show was a pretty formal affair. Letterman brought on a sillier time, Conan branded ridiculous, Jimmy Fallon probably doesn't even own a tuxedo. Late night isn't just for old folks anymore. Where's Doc Severinsen? Tuxedos in radio? I've got mine on. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, March 6th. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea, and for Adora Udoji, who happily has a new daughter from adoption. Coming up this hour, a surprising take on how to solve auto industry troubles. We'll bring you a conversation with someone who would rather see GM die, plus an explanation of America's changing stance on the tough problem of Iran. Those stories and more ahead, but first, these headlines.
30 minutes and counting until a report that could rock the markets. Monthly unemployment numbers are coming, and economists fear bad news. The markets may have priced it all in, but the consensus is about 650,000 jobs disappeared in February. That would take the national jobless rate to 7.9%. That's the expected number. The real number we'll bring you once they're out in a half an hour. We'll see what Wall Street thinks about all this. As for world markets, it hasn't been a pretty day. Major Asian markets sunk, with Japan's Nikkei index losing 3.5%. European markets also mostly down.
A bill to help troubled homeowners is one step closer to reality. The House passed a measure to give some of those troubled borrowers facing foreclosures access to lower interest rates. Lawmakers voted mostly on party lines. The bill must now make it through the Senate, where it could change. Some big holes also remain in the Obama administration. CNN medical correspondent and gatherer of fans, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, won't take the Surgeon General gig. He told his co-worker Larry King that family matters drove his decision.
I think for me it really came down to a sense of timing more than anything else. You know, I have two daughters. Our third daughter is now imminent. In fact, I got my phone on right here. I might get called off the set. As we talk, my wife is imminent with our third child.
All this is two high-level Treasury Department candidates are taking themselves out of the running. This means Secretary Tim Geithner's top deputy post is still empty, among others. Geithner has drawn criticism from inside and outside of the administration about the many vacancies still unfilled at Treasury.
Dismal day yesterday on Wall Street. The S&P begins trading this morning at 682. Unemployment numbers likely to have some effect. Watchmen envisions a world where Richard Nixon never left office. What do you think would have happened today if Nixon had stayed in power?
Hello, my name is Dave from White Plains. If Nixon never left office, Vietnam would become the 51st state, and we would become a manufacturing international powerhouse.
And Dave from White Plains would be working for the CIA. Tell us what would have changed if Nixon had never left, and what forks in the road you would love to go back to change the course of history. Tell us your stories at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Farai Chidea, sitting in for Adora Udoji, who's on maternity leave.
And I'm John Hockenberry. We begin this hour with a Wednesday issuance from the International Criminal Court in The Hague, a warrant for the arrest of sitting president Sudanese Omar al-Bashir for alleged war crimes in the Darfur region. And the nation of Sudan was quick to respond.
Allahu Akbar!
Allahu Akbar!
Allahu Akbar!
Allahu Akbar!
La ilaha illallah!
President Bashir addressing huge crowds in Khartoum, crowds supporting him with patriotic and religious chants, but it's not clear what everyone in Sudan believes. It is clear that international aid agencies are being expelled. 13 agencies have been kicked out of the Darfur region this week in the wake of the issuance of the arrest warrant. What's it all going to mean? The UN's Deputy Humanitarian Chief Catherine Bragg had this to say.
While we're looking into contingency planning to fill the gaps left by these expulsions, it will be extremely challenging for the remaining humanitarian organizations and the government of Sudan to fill the operating gap. And we do not see how these gaps can be fully covered.
Well, the International Criminal Court issued this arrest warrant, and there have been ripples in the humanitarian sector as well as the political sector. Joining us now is Nick Grano, a deputy president for operations at the International Crisis Group. He's in Brussels. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And David Clatworthy is coordinator of water and sanitation in Darfur on the ground. He's for one of the expelled aid agencies, the International Rescue Committee. He is in Nairobi. David, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, John.
All right, great. Let's begin with you, Nick. What is the political reaction? This is the first arrest warrant for a sitting president. It seems as though in the early going, President Bashir has used this for political advantage. What is the political reaction within Sudan and around the continent?
Well, the political reaction in Sudan has been mixed. You played a clip with President Bashir, kind of with crowds there. But in the camps, many of the people who have been the victims of the conflict have welcomed the decision of the International Criminal Court because they see that there's a possibility that President Bashir will be held accountable for the crimes that have been committed against them. And the international community has been fairly cautious in its response, I think, waiting to see how some of this plays out.
Now, the African Union has suggested that Thabo Mbeki be appointed to investigate international war crimes or genocidal accusations independently of the International Criminal Court. Is this seen as an attempt to, route around the International Criminal Court, or would this be in parallel? Would this amplify what the International Criminal Court has done here?
It's not clear yet. The announcement's just come out. I mean, if the intention is for him to somehow interfere with the International Criminal Court process, then that would be inappropriate. The International Criminal Court's an international court. South Africa and 30 African countries have signed up to the court, along with 70 or more countries around the world. And, it's an independent institution that has a role to investigate claims of atrocities in Sudan and should be allowed to continue with its work.
And it's not as though Mbeki has much of a track record after failing to effectively mediate the situation in Zimbabwe. David Clatworthy, tell us what the impact on the ground in humanitarian terms is of these expulsions.
John, the impact on the ground is really very large indeed. We've had, as you know, 13 agencies have had their licenses revoked, and those include really most of the large NGOs working in Darfur and working in North Sudan. Certainly our programs cover 650,000 people in Darfur and an even larger number in North and East Sudan. And it's going to have a very big impact on those people, and other organizations also will be facing a similar situation.
I just wanted, this is Farai, by the way, I just wanted to follow up on that. I spoke with an aid worker from another NGO relief group, someone who was really working on the ground in a medical capacity, and this person was very loath to publicly address any of the politics. And is there a sense that folks from perhaps your organization or any other operating there just have to be very circumspect and very careful about what you say, or else you might not be able to get back into the country? I'm just being frank here.
Well, we are, as a humanitarian organization, we really do need to focus on unmet needs of the people who are affected by disaster or conflict and so on. So we operate within a political space, obviously, but we're neutral. We focus on the needs of the people there. So I think that the lack of comment is really probably related to that.
All right. Well, then, Nick, let's address this to you. I mean, is the net effect of this to further isolate Darfur and the people of Darfur? And has the International Criminal Court played into President Bashir's hands?
Well, I think we have to, face the situation that Bashir is responsible for. President Bashir is responsible for what is happening. He's essentially trying to hold more than a million civilians, his most vulnerable citizens, hostage in his confrontation with the international community. And I think what you should see, or well, I hope we'll see, is that the allies of Sudan, such as Arab League and African Union states and China, are working frantically behind the scenes to encourage him to step back from the brink. President Bashir could change this order tomorrow. And I hope that there is pressure being brought to bear on him, because otherwise those states that are in a position to change the situation will be, not complicit but party to what is going on.
Nick, I'm going to follow up with you. I got a chance to speak to the president of Senegal, and he essentially said, you know what, there's a lot of tribal factionalism in Sudan. Don't blame President Bashir. What do you think of that?
Well, I think you have an independent institution here, the International Criminal Court, that was given this referral by the UN Security Council and has conducted a very thorough investigation over the last 2 or 3 years. And as a result of that, has come out and found that there is a case to answer for President Bashir on crimes against humanity and war crimes. It didn't find him responsible at this stage for the possibility of genocide. The international community has been a supporter of the International Criminal Court, and I think it's the right time for the international community to say, we support this international and independent institution, and we should let it go about its work.
Although, Nick, the Security Council has been stopped by China's refusal to do anything other than either veto or abstain from resolutions, and Russia has even criticized this International Criminal Court decision to issue an arrest warrant. I guess what's frustrating to me is what we saw last year in Myanmar, Burma, another one of these hostage situations where a government, for its own reasons, maintains large segments of its population in extreme humanitarian stress, and the international community can do almost nothing about it. It seems like this is becoming more of a pattern than simply an example of Bashir acting alone.
Yeah, but I think that also illustrates, I mean, it's a very good example, but it also illustrates the importance of international justice. You know, unless those perpetrating these atrocities are held accountable, then there will be continued impunity. And I also think that states that have a strong relationship with perpetrators, so in this case China and its relationship, it gets very large oil supplies from Sudan, need to think about the reputational costs that are incurred if they stand by while President Bashir essentially denies humanitarian assistance to over a million civilians. There will be a cost for China and others that are in a position to influence the Sudanese government if they don't take a strong stance on this.
David, Farai, I think, very responsibly raises the issue that you cannot be completely candid, but is there a buzz among the NGOs there in the rumor mill of Nairobi that Farai and I know very, very well, of what the possible scenario might be of your organizations getting back in? Is there a quid pro quo even being talked about behind the scenes?
John, we'll be trying to appeal the decision with the government of Sudan, and I know that organizations are appealing to the government, not just the NGOs, but UN and so on. We'll just have to see what happens. We very much hope that it will be revoked.
And what about the question of genocide? Nick, that word has been used by some, decried by others. What do you think?
Well, genocide is a very difficult charge to prove, because you not only have to prove that there's been mass slaughter, murders, atrocities, but there was a specific intent by President Bashir in this case to wipe out ethnic groups because of their ethnicity or religious groups, etc. The court came out and said essentially there's not enough evidence before us, and if you get more evidence then you can come back to us and present another charge of genocide. So I think at this stage we have to bear in mind that the court has said there's a case to answer on these very, very serious crimes of crimes against humanity and war crimes, and focus on that. If more information comes available, then I suspect that there will be another attempt to charge President Bashir with genocide.
Well, there's a process of slow wheels of international justice in a situation where the humanitarian urgency is certainly accelerating. From Brussels, Nick Grano, Deputy President for Operations at the International Crisis Group. And from Nairobi, David Clatworthy, Coordinator of Water and Sanitation in Darfur for the International Rescue Committee. Thanks to both of you for joining us today. Reaction to the arrest warrant for President Bashir of Sudan over alleged war crimes in Darfur. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea. Unemployment numbers come out in 10 minutes, and we're already hearing your thoughts.
Good morning. This is Mark from Massachusetts. I'll tell you about an unemployment group that no one's thinking about, people who want to re-enter the workforce. I took time off to be a stay-at-home dad. Now that my son is well entrenched in school, I wanted to go back to work. Well, that's not possible now, is it?
Well, hopefully it is. Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE, your personal stories, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
So Robert Farrago joins us. He's a blogger from thetruthaboutcars.com in our outtake segment in the program this morning, where we hear a provocative view of a situation in the news. And, of course, all of you know what the GM announced yesterday. In its annual report, it disclosed that there's substantial doubt that General Motors, once the largest auto company in the world, could continue as a going concern, as an actual company, basically raising the specter of bankruptcy, which has been raised numerous times as GM has come to the Federal Treasury begging for billions it's already received. Robert Farrago, good morning.
Good morning.
And your view on all this is that the troubles of the U.S. auto industry are really emblematic of a bigger issue of a car bubble that is now bursting, that basically there are too many cars, there's excess capacity for manufacturing, and that shrinkage is in order somehow.
Well, it's not only in order, it's inevitable. General Motors is already bankrupt. We're just talking about a zombie car maker here that's living off of taxpayer money. There's no way that company can come back, and the money that's been so-called loaned to them is gone. It'll never come back. It's disappeared. And giving them more money makes no sense whatsoever, or Chrysler.
In the macroeconomic sort of perspective, keeping those people employed as a matter of sort of stimulating the economy, even if they are a zombie corporation, does that have any merit even for a period of years?
Well, in an alternative universe, perhaps. Back here in the real world, we're telling people or paying people to build cars that people aren't buying. What are we going to do, stack them up on railway yards and in ports as they are now? The industry has to contract. There are just not enough buyers for all the cars that can be made by all the car makers. And General Motors fought in that competition for the consumer dollar and lost. And to prop it up now is a huge waste of money. We would be actually better off sending every United Auto worker $100,000 check than to give GM and Chrysler another $21.6 billion.
What would you say to you to an alternative use for the money that's gone to General Motors, say as a matter of assisting economic development in the Detroit area or compensating communities that are losing factories? Would the Treasury money have better value doing something like that?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. Propping up a failed enterprise like General Motors is an enormous waste of money. General Motors can't compete. It has proven this beyond a shadow of a doubt. This is not just a train wreck that happened in the last year. This is something that's been going on for 30 years. The company has squandered all its financial resources, every last dollar. It's gone. It's dead. It has to go.
I think that would be a car wreck, maybe not a train wreck.
Okay, well, they do transport cars on trains.
That's true.
But this is Farai. It strikes me, I want to go a little bit deeper into the question of the ripple effects on communities. A lot of folks have argued that the stimulus is just too targeted on specific communities that we say are in need when a lot of people are in need. Do you think that there's a geographic angle to this at all?
Well, the automakers we're talking about are based in Detroit. There is an automotive industry which is not in Detroit, in America. In fact, over half of the cars made in America are not made by Detroit-owned automakers. It's a fairly complicated issue, the industry, because remember, General Motors builds a lot of cars outside the country. Chrysler builds most of its cars in Canada. Ford is looking for its savior in Mexico. So, you know, by giving these companies money, it doesn't necessarily help Detroit as much as what you say, which would be a direct aid package
right.
to them.
Well, and Toyota itself is looking at some shrinkage because of bad decisions it's made in this market, producing trucks that perhaps people aren't interested in. Let's, before we go, talk about two things. One, where is the demand engine broadly in the global market for cars that might revive car demand, let alone forget General Motors for the moment? And is shrinkage absolutely essential if we're to go from the current technology of cars to what is envisioned by the Obama administration of some futuristic electric car world?
Well, that's a very complicated question. Let me try and come at it from a couple of different angles quickly. First of all, shrinkage is inevitable. It's like a law of nature. Before the industry went into this debacle or the economic meltdown, they had 30% overcapacity then. That's the bubble that you mentioned at the beginning. Now the overcapacity may be 40% or even 60%. So a shrinkage is inevitable. No matter what the government does or doesn't do, that market demands that car makers either go out of business or be propped up by tax money, which, again, makes no sense to me. In terms of the cars of the future, the price of fuel and federal legislation are going to determine that, not which automakers survive. And there will be fewer at the end of this.
So the fuel side that's going to regulate the new technology and determine the products, it's going to be up to consumers to determine what the demand engine is going to be once those products are in place and what businesses there will be. My guest, Robert Farrago, is a blogger for thetruthaboutcars.com with an outtake you won't hear anywhere else. Let them fail. Shrinkage is inevitable. Forget saving GM under any circumstances. There's the takeaway. And now with the takeaway headlines, Femi, okay.
Thanks, John. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Good morning. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the Bush administration neglected the problem of global climate change. She spoke at the European Parliament today, part of a wide-ranging European trip. She said the Obama administration puts a high priority on cooperating globally to solve the climate change problem. Next, she goes to Geneva to meet with her Russian counterpart. A federal judge has lifted a freeze on some 12,000 accounts opened with Texas investor Alan Stanford. He faces multi-billion dollar fraud allegations. The accounts were all valued at $250,000 or less, and the thaw opens the way for some Stanford clients to get their money back. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner still has some holes to fill in his senior staff. Annette Nazareff, his choice to be his top deputy, has removed her name from consideration. It's reportedly a personal decision, not tied to tax revelations. A candidate for another top spot also withdrew her name, and some have criticised Geithner for not filling his high-level posts faster. And the Air Force is beginning special inspections for hundreds of its C-130 transport planes. Cracks were found on bolts that hold the wings on during a routine maintenance of one plane.
They need the wings on the planes.
I would
Those
say
are important parts.
Pretty essential.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Sure. C-130s without wings, that wouldn't work. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Farai Jadeh is here for Doria Doji. And we've been waiting for these numbers all morning. We finally have them. Unemployment, the jobless rate has jumped to 8.1% in February. That's the highest since late 1983. Payrolls dropped by 651,000. That's how many jobs disappeared in February. It's a higher number than was expected, but the futures are so far rallying. The markets are kind of digesting this number. Also, we've been talking about this week that the movie Watchmen comes out. It actually opens today, and it envisions a world where Nixon never left office. What do you think would have happened today if one point in history had changed?
Hi, this is Carol Johnson from Salt Lake City. I think if Robert Kennedy had not been assassinated, we would have health care for decades. Ah, what a wonderful world it would be.
You imagine what fork in the road you'd love to go back to change the course of history. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Smart man would leave now, but welcome to the first episode of Late Night with Jimmy Fallon.
Hosting late night talk shows has turned into musical chairs, and Jimmy Fallon landed in Conan O'Brien's former throne. Fallon debuted this Monday as the host of NBC's Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. Can he fill the shoes of giants like Conan and David Letterman? And how's the late night audience changing? We've got Troy Patterson, the TV critic for Slate. So thumbs up, down, sideways. What do you think, Troy?
I'm going to give him a wiggly thumbs up.
Really?
Really? It's charming in many ways. The wiggle because he started out very nervous.
He seemed pretty terrified.
Squirming throughout the show. But already in his first 3 or 4 days, he's started to get his legs under him and gain some more confidence.
Well, he got some big guests, and Conan came on to riff off that with him.
Who's on the show this week?
Oh, we got a great first week. We got Robert De Niro, Drew Barrymore, Tina Fey, Justin Timberlake.
Great guests.
Yeah.
It's killer.
Yeah.
Who's on next week?
We have, so far, Jervis from Survivor, season one, and Right Said Fred.
Troy, how hard is the booking aspect of this? And how much, well, you know, when you think about a late night show, there's the chemistry of the host with the audience, and then there's the chemistry of the host with the guest, and then there's all, you know, the Roots crew is part of this show. So what's going to make this a winner if it becomes a winner?
What's going to make this, I don't think that, I mean, it's important to book interesting guests, but it's much more important for the host to sort of be limber enough to be able to engage whoever is sitting on the couch. In Jimmy Fallon's case, what's going to make him succeed or fail is how sort of quickly and how confidently he can discover his own voice so that he needs not simply to mimic what Letterman and Conan O'Brien have done before him, but to sort of adapt the format for his personality and for these times.
And Conan struggled, I remember.
Conan struggled for the first
really
two or three years.
It's because he had red hair. It was like
he was so tall.
What was that police show? You know, help me out here.
Car 54, where are you?
I'm David Caruso.
Ah, yes.
but he survived the red hair curse.
He did. Well, in Conan's case, he of the sort of big late-night talk show host, he was the only one without a solid background in performing.
He was a writer. He was an SNL writer that Lorne Michaels pulled out of the writing crew
and pushed
forward.
Precisely. Whereas, Leno and Letterman have had these backgrounds in stand-up, and Dave Letterman had further done sort of some acting work and had an ill-fated morning show.
I remember watching it, yeah.
You were the only one.
The morning show, yeah. Oh, I was in the hospital for a long time. I remember I used to watch it every day. I went, who this guy? He'll never make it, you know. Stick with my instincts, baby. Yeah.
What do we know about the demographics of late night? I mean, television, like all media, is taking its hits. Is late night strong in general, and are the audience demographics changing? Do we know anything about that?
Late night, I believe, has suffered less attrition than a lot of other day parts, as they call them, on the networks. And what's especially important to remember about the 12:30 slot is that all of these guys sort of, you know, necessarily gain their sort of initial core audience among college students, because who else can stay up until 1:35 in the morning
Word.
Laughing at jokes?
Right. But that wasn't always the case. I mean, the Tonight Show, it's not 12:30, it's the other, it's the 11:30 hour, which is a different time, was an old kind of fogey, sit around in smoking jackets kind of a feel that began in the 50s and morphed quite a lot.
Yeah, I suppose. Although there's a way in which the Tonight Show kind of tucks you into bed.
Right.
And on Johnny Carson's show, it was relatively youthful. It had some snap, and so I can fondly remember being kind of a 10-year-old, and
right.
in addition to the excitement of being allowed to stay up late, there was this...
So it's been getting younger and younger and younger in late night for really a generation now.
That's true, yes.
Well, I want to jump on another issue here. Comedian D.L. Hughley just announced he's ending his Saturday night show on CNN, and the show got blasted at first, but it seemed to be shaping up. So does that have any ripple effects?
No, it doesn't. because maybe part of the problem with the show was that it was sort of anomalous. And you know, CNN has made a few stabs at trying to meld news coverage and comedy, and they've all been disastrous, to be kind
right.
about it.
Right. Well, it's orphaned there, I guess.
We know that he didn't shy away from controversy.
The tenets of the Republican Party are amazing, and they seem warm and welcome. But when I watch it be applied, like, you didn't have to go much further than the Republican National Convention. It literally looked like Nazi Germany.
Yeah,
it really
yeah.
did. And I said that point. It just does not seem like they don't even care what we think.
Now, that's DL talking to Republican National Committee Chair Michael Steele. It was Steele, Chuck D, and DL. And I have to say, it was pretty amazing and amusing. But did the Nazi Germany comments, you think, make him a little unfresh for CNN?
Well, they certainly couldn't have helped. I mean, on three levels. First of all, the joke's in bad taste. And then there's a matter of it's not being terribly even-handed, kind of indicative of sort of the liberal bias that some people like to talk about. But maybe most importantly, it's just not a good joke.
Okay, Troy, thanks for coming into the studio. Troy Patterson, TV critic for Slate, and Femi Okay with the news.
Good morning. The time is just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Just got these figures in the last couple of moments. The jobless rate has hit 8.1%, and those numbers came out just about 5 or 6 minutes ago. And these are the highest since 1983 and a little bit worse than economists were predicting. The IRS will drop a program that uses private debt collectors to go after tax delinquents. The agency says that its own employees will do a better job. That's a look at two headlines making news this morning. I'll be back with more in 10 minutes' time.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
I'm Farai Chidea, sitting in for Adora Udoji, who's on maternity leave.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Well, he wrote the book, the e-book anyway, called Dumb Money, How Our Greatest Financial Minds Bankrupted the Nation. It's available on Kindle. But Dan Gross, any money at all, dumb or otherwise, would be welcome in this economy. The numbers just out this morning, 8.1% unemployment rate in February. Dan, I don't want to do a what's the market reaction kind of ultimately moronic story. What I would like to do is inquire with you, what does this directly have an impact on in the broader economy? It seems to me retail is the first answer, and we're going to start seeing businesses going away for good at this point, right?
Well, that's too bad, because I had my moronic response prepared.
Oh, yes!
Which is that the market would like to see clarity from Washington.
That's perfect. You're hired on CNBC.
At least someone will get hired somewhere, right?
That's right.
Look, this the number is actually not quite as bad as feared. People were talking about 700,000 jobs being lost. In fact, only 650,000 were. To me, the most distressing number is not that 8.1% unemployment rate, but the U6 figure, which calculates the unemployed and people who are working part-time because they want to be, but want to be working full-time, and people who've given up, that number is up to 14.8%,
oh, wow,
highest it's ever been, which indicates that there's a lot of people who really want to be working but can't find enough work to keep them busy. And as you do note, this is bad for the retail business. We are going to continue, and I think what the indication is, and it's a kind of chicken and egg thing, when you see companies fail, like Circuit City, a lot of other retailers, rather than reorganize and reopen and shrink, they're just shutting down and liquidating. So Circuit City did that. You're seeing this with newspapers. And kind of that's what happens when there's a sense that there isn't good consumer demand because the job situation is so bad. A lot of people figure, why go to the trouble of trying to stick it out as a business? Why knock ourselves out if we're just not going to make it? And, of course, that contributes to further job loss.
Right. I mean, you've described the cycle there sort of perfectly. Some have tried to find some silver linings inside these numbers. There is a year-to-year hourly wage number that's up about 3%. Is that just an anomaly, or is anyone likely to feel that wages are rising?
I wouldn't read too much into that. If you want, I don't know if it's good news, but thank God for government and for education and healthcare, because those are the only sectors that added jobs. And the encouraging thing about that, not that we want government to control the economy, is that there was all this concern that, you know, states running out of funds, like California, were furloughing people and laying people off. Some of the stimulus package that's funneling money to the states may put a brake on that. The government is the employer of last resort. It's holding steady. That's the only piece of good news I can find.
Last resort and first resort. Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek, of course, author of the new ebook, Dumb Money, How Our Greatest Financial Minds Bankrupted the Nation. It's available on Kindle. And Takeaway listeners who send an email to dumbmoneybook@gmail.com can get a free first chapter. And Dan Gross will find all the good news for you, if there is any, or at least the humorous news on why dumb money happened to all of us. Thanks, Dan. And remember, unemployment rate, 8.1%, just out this morning.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. It's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's party, and she'll invite Iran if she wants to. What am I talking about? Find out after headlines from Femi Yoke in just a moment.
Thanks, John. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The big news from the Labor Department this morning: the jobless rate has hit 8.1%, and those numbers came out in the last 20 minutes or so. It's the highest level since 1983 and a little bit worse than economists were predicting. On a more positive employment note, President Barack Obama heads to Ohio's capital, Columbus, today to attend the graduation of 25 police recruits who owe their jobs to the stimulus package. They have been laid off while still training, but money from the package will pay their salaries. In international news, the United Nations says it will investigate whether Sudan's decision to expel humanitarian groups is a war crime. The Sudanese government ordered 13 of the largest aid organizations to leave after the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for President Omar al-Bashir. He's accused of crimes involving the Darfur region. The UN says that kicking aid groups out put lives at risk. And NASA's mission to find planets just like Earth should be lifting off later today. The Kepler telescope will study a very small patch of the Milky Way. Bill Borowski is the Kepler mission's principal investigator.
We're interested in planets like that of Earth, rocky planets in an orbit where life might be possible. We're hoping to find hundreds, of course. Although Kepler will not find E.T., it's hoping to find E.T.'s home.
So, how common are planets like ours? That's the question the Kepler mission is hoping to be able to answer. The mission is expected to last 3.5 years. And that's your news.
Reporting from outer space, Femi OK. That was great. You can't resist, can you? We love Femi OK. So there are more signs of change in both style and substance in the new Obama diplomacy as far as Iran is concerned. Iran has been extended an invitation by the Obama administration to a meeting to discuss Afghanistan.
If we move forward with such a meeting, it is expected that Iran would be invited as a neighbor of Afghanistan.
A high-level international conference on Afghanistan to be held later this month. Iran is on the invitation list. Is this a raising of Iran's profile by the Obama administration or more of a sign of Obama's delicate approach in dancing toward an actual bilateral relationship with Iran? Joining us is Ali Ansari, professor of Iranian studies at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So what do you think? Iran is a neighbor of Afghanistan. Iran is a neighbor of Iraq. In both cases, it seems that Iran has managed to raise its profile in regional affairs in both conflict zones. What does this invitation mean as far as Iran's profile as a mediator or as a player in regional diplomatic affairs?
Well, we should bear in mind that Iran has raised its profile in large part because of a consequence of the, you know, the global war on terror and the wars that have taken place in Afghanistan and Iraq. And we should also remember that, of course, Iran was quite pivotal in the conduct of the war in Afghanistan in post 9/11, and of course in the establishment of the government there. So, in many ways, this invitation marks a return to the pre-Axis of Evil era, when even the Bush administration saw some merit in cooperating with Iran.
But pre-Axis of Evil, Iran, post-hostage crisis, has been very much a pariah nation in the United States. Mm. Does the invitation to a high-level meeting on Afghanistan constitute a sort of diplomatic cover for what ultimately might result in actual a bilateral relationship?
Well, I think it's a very significant step, and I think it's a good start. I think that the calculations must be being made in the Obama administration that it would be good to start on something in which there's a strong coincidence of interests. Let's work on something where the Iranians and the coalition and the United States in particular share a number of common interests and a desire to see a stable Afghanistan. And if we can build a relationship of trust there, then other things may open up and other things may be possible.
Professor, specifically, what is Iran's interest and capability in helping the situation in Afghanistan?
Well, principally, Iran would like to see, obviously, Afghanistan stable and secure. It would like it to be it has large difficulties in terms of smuggling, refugees, the drug problem that goes across the Afghan border into Iran. But principally, I think it would like to make sure that the Taliban don't seize power in Afghanistan. They've got a strong antithesis towards them. They nearly went to war against the Taliban in 1998. So in that particular sphere, they share a very strong common interest with the United States.
Professor, what about freedom of the press? I recently had the chance to meet an Iranian journalist who was essentially in exile in the U.S. He said that one thing he said was on his resume, there were about 20 papers, and someone asked him, why can't you keep a job? He's like, I do keep a job. The papers just keep getting shut down. What's the ability of Iranian people to freely discuss their own politics in their own papers?
Well, clearly there is censorship at work in Iran, and I think the situation has become considerably worse since the current president took office in 2005, by which I mean, you know, Mr. Ahmadinejad. I think prior to that, things were a good deal more open, but more importantly, I think the direction of the direction in which it was going was much more healthy. Now, I think what you find in Iran is that you find a lot of keen journalists, enthusiastic journalists. I mean, the structures are very much in place, and one would hope that if you have a change in the political environment, perhaps after June, that perhaps this press freedom that had existed up to a point, but to quite an impressive point, really, in the during the period in which President Khatami had been in office, maybe this can be resuscitated.
So let's talk about the nuclear issue, because normally discussions about Iran's role in the world begin and end with the nuclear question. Is it possible that the Obama administration might be trying to create a second track here where nuclear is one dispute and that other questions of bilateral cooperation can be negotiated in another forum or on another track, sort of the way administrations have dealt with China? China in the recent years?
I think that's absolutely right. I think what you find is there's been basically a dead end with the nuclear negotiations, and I've always said that negotiations is something of a misnomer when it comes to this, because it really hasn't got anywhere. So what you do is you try to find other routes where progress may be possible. And, of course, Afghanistan, as I said earlier, is one area where there is a strong coincidence of interests. Let's build a certain relationship of trust there. Let's show both sides to show, because there are obviously hawks on both sides that may not want this to succeed. So what you have to show is that, look, this works, that we can talk to the Americans or we can talk to the Iranians and we can produce results. And if we can do it in this area, why don't we shift and look at the other areas where there are disagreements?
It's almost a yes or no answer, but can Iran counterbalance Pakistan's difficulties in Afghanistan if they were to really step up to the table here?
I think that's the way it's been going for some time, but it's been going in that direction very much behind the scenes. But, you know, this idea that there's been no sort of a collaboration on a sort of on a local level, even over the last few years, there has obviously been a certain amount of discussion at local level, not at an official level, obviously.
Right.
But it's very difficult to ignore Iran when it comes to Afghanistan. And I think even officials on the ground in Afghanistan have been crucially aware of that. I suspect it's from that direction that the influence has been placed on the politicians.
Ali Ansari, director of the Institute for Iranian Studies at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. Iran as a counterbalance to Pakistan vis-a-vis Afghanistan, a very interesting diplomacy takeaway in the Obama administration. Fry?
And we want to hear about what you think might happen if Nixon had never left office. That's a conceit in The Watchman. What would it be like if he never left? Here's Troy.
Good morning. Troy calling from North Dakota. If Nixon were still in power, there would not have been a President Clinton nor a Monica Lewinsky scandal, especially when considering the physically unappealing Nixon. To fill that scandal void, Nixon would have inevitably stalked Attorney General Janet Reno on Facebook, which would have coined the term Renoing, meaning to cyberstalk an unattractive coworker.
Wow, he's on.
That's Troy, man. That's Troy. Yeah.
Are there other forks in the road that you would love or hate to go back to change the course of history? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
We would be actually better off sending every United Auto worker $100,000 check than to give GM and Chrysler another $21.6 billion.
That's Robert Farrago, blogger from thetruthaboutcars.com, talking about a multi-billion dollar bailout for GM. Good riddance to GM. GM says the company's viability is, quote, in substantial doubt.
And big surprise.
Yeah, if you missed our conversation about GM or Sudan or late night or anything else in the show, you should listen on the website, thetakeaway.org, or sign up for our podcast. Fascinating stuff. I'm Farai Chidea.
We should remind you, unemployment numbers came out just about a half hour ago, 8.1%, 650,000 jobs lost in the month of February. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
...8.1% unemployment. I'm daydreaming about an economy that's just a memory.
There's a new era in automobiles. It's the new Motoramic Chevrolet. What's new? Everything.
Once upon a time, a new era in motoring meant fancy chrome fins and colorful upholstery. The only turbo left in Chevrolet is how fast General Motors has plummeted toward bankruptcy.
A revolutionary new ride plus new power. It's the new Motoramic Chevrolet.
Motoring into nearly 10% unemployment. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, March 6th. I'm the very turbocharged John Hockenberry. Good morning, Farai.
Thank you. And I'm Farai Chidea, in for Adora Udoji, who's on leave with her new baby. Coming up this hour, politicians talked at a summit meeting yesterday, but we'll break down what healthcare changes could actually mean for you. Also, how China's slowing economy could smack your pocketbook. Those stories and more ahead, but first these headlines.
Check your friends and neighbors. 8.1% of the workforce is out of work from a new report out last hour, the highest unemployment rate since 1983. It was actually a bit worse than economists predicted in some areas. Employers slashed some 651,000 jobs in February. Many of those newly unemployed now have enhanced fears about falling behind on their mortgages. A bill to help troubled homeowners could avoid foreclosure, and that's moving ahead. The House passed the measure last night to give some borrowers access to lower interest rates. It was a party line vote. The bill must now make it through the Senate.
And looking overseas, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton meets with Russia's foreign minister in just a few hours. The Obama administration is interested in Russian help on halting Iran's nuclear program.
We continue to believe that we have to take all steps necessary to protect ourselves, our friends, our allies from a potential aggressive action in the future from Iran.
Speaking in Brussels, Clinton also slapped the Bush administration, saying it neglected climate change. Clinton runs the State Department, but over at the Treasury, HR problems continue. Secretary Tim Geithner's choice for his chief deputy is pulling out. Her move is reportedly a personal decision to keep her current job as a law partner. Some say Geithner is moving too slowly on hiring top deputies.
Wanted one Surgeon General, CNN medical correspondent Dr. Sanjay Gupta says he won't take the job. He says it will be too hard on his family with two young children and another on the way. He prefers to stay with CNN, where he jets around the world all the time reporting on healthcare stories. Yes, that's great for his family. The Dow and S&P both plummeted yesterday, losing more than 4%. I have nothing against Sanjay. I have nothing against him.
He's got good hair.
He's got huge hair. Neither has been this low since the 1990s. The S&P starts trading at 682, folks. We've been talking this week about the big Watchmen movie, but we're not going to talk about the movie. What we do want to talk about is something that happens inside the movie. It envisions what would have happened to history if Richard Nixon hadn't resigned in 1974. How would history have changed? Think of huge forks in the road historically. Go back to them and call us with your change that might have happened if. Okay, we already got a call from someone saying if Robert Kennedy hadn't been assassinated, we would have health care in America today. What's your speculation? Forks in history, 8778 my take or my take at thetakeaway.org. Or just wonder what would happen if Nixon was still with us.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. Responsibilityproject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Such a small number, 8.1%, but so many faces buried deep in that number. And some of them actually called to react to the unemployment numbers that were announced today. 8.1% of American workers are unemployed. 650,000 or more lost their jobs in just the month of February. It's a trend that has been continuing. The question is it accelerating? Earlier on the program, we were discussing whether General Motors, whose woes are well known and we've reported on continually on the program, is just a zombie corporation and we shouldn't even bother propping it up. Well, someone reacting to the unemployment figures had this to say to us.
This is Bill Barber from Sterling Heights, Michigan. I'm a former Chrysler worker who took a voluntary separation in order to preserve my medical care and a very, very small pension. While I agree in principle that propping up, quote, zombie corporations is a bad thing to do, that the unemployment rate in Michigan is 11%. And if GM and Chrysler go down, it's going to 25, and that's not hyperbole when you count all the suppliers. So watch out, America.
Finding hyperbole in this economic situation is actually difficult. What seemed ridiculous just a year ago is now coming to pass. Thinking about the unemployment statistics, another voice from our listenership had this to say.
Good morning. This is Mark from Massachusetts. I'll tell you about
an unemployment group that no one's thinking about, people who want to re-enter the workforce. I took time off to be a stay-at-home dad. Now that my son is well entrenched in school, I wanted to go back to work. Well, that's not possible now, is it?
Virtually all the assumptions about employment and what this economy is going to look like going forward are at least subject to question with these latest numbers that are out. David Leonhard writes the Economic Scene column every Wednesday in the New York Times. He joins us from his home in Maryland. David, you know, react to those two voices. Michigan going to 25% if the auto industry goes down. We got 8.1% unemployment right now. If you're a stay-at-home dad, you're not going back to the workforce anytime soon.
Yeah, I think there were actually there was one really important point in both of those calls that you played. One of the things we saw in the statistics this month was an increase in the number of people looking for work. Now, that could just be a statistical anomaly, but some of those people are exactly in the category of that stay-at-home dad. They're people who were outside the labor force and for whatever reason came back into the labor force looking for work, and obviously right now had an incredibly difficult time finding a job and didn't find a job. And so that was actually a big part of the unemployment rate spike this month. It was sort of half real. It was half people losing their jobs, and it was half people moving from officially unofficially unemployed to officially unemployed. And the first caller from Michigan, I mean, if the auto industries were to go under, it would be absolutely horrible. The unemployment rate would not go to 25%. The industry has put out somewhat exaggerated numbers on how big the suppliers are as a share of the economy. But his larger point was absolutely spot on, which is as much as it may make sense to let GM or Chrysler fail in another time, and sort of emotionally that's my instinct. You know, they've been mismanaged for so long. Why are we spending taxpayer dollars on them? Right now it would just be a terrible form of basically anti-stimulus.
Right, and it would, you know, Hoovervilles would be, you know, a kind of epithet that would come to mind about government insensitivity to a community like Detroit, where people, it's already been described to us, are in a kind of a state of fear day to day, looking at the headlines. But let's think for a minute. You mentioned the people returning to the workforce or returning to the statistical radar because they've decided they want to go back to work but can't get work.
Yeah,
that itself could be a recessionary indicator in that they're possibly responding to a loss of income in another area. Maybe a spouse is out of work, so suddenly they're going back to work.
That's right. Or maybe they were thinking of themselves as early retired and they got their 401k statement and they thought again. So it's really tricky to read too much into a single month's trend, but on the other hand, an hour after the unemployment numbers have come out, we don't really have any choice. And we really did see that the last month. We saw this increase of people in the labor force, and I think you're right. I think it could be people whose spouse has lost their job. It could be people who can't retire when they want to, and obviously for them finding work right now is incredibly difficult. You asked the question of is it accelerating or not, and it's almost this strange existential question, because what the Labor Department does is they, not only do they announce the new numbers for February today, but they revise the previous 2 months. They always do that when they get more data in. And they keep revising the earlier months to look even worse. And so job cuts have not actually accelerated in the last couple months, but that's only because December and January were a lot worse than they first told us. And so we've had about now 650,000 job losses in each of the last 3 months.
David, this is Farai Chidea. I want to ask a comparison question. There was an interesting report in USA Today, which I always like saying, that more than half of the nation's foreclosures took place in just 35 counties. And, you know, that had a huge ripple effect. Is there a geographic clustering of unemployment? I mean, we keep mentioning Detroit, one of my favorite cities, actually. But do we know anything about the geography of unemployment?
We do. It's really broad-based. The only part of the country that isn't suffering rapid job loss right now is this belt from the Dakotas to Texas, going down the middle of the country. And the two things about that is that much of that belt has very little population, right? The Dakotas, Nebraska, Kansas, relative to the rest of the country, is fairly sparsely populated. And the second thing is that is in part a legacy of the high oil and high commodity prices, and those have obviously gone away. So we should expect that there will be job cuts there. The rest of the country is going through job cuts, and the worst ones are in two areas. Those counties you just mentioned, any place where there was a huge housing bubble, they've obviously lost lots and lots of construction jobs. They've lost local finance jobs, people who are refinancing those mortgages and servicing them. So that's California and Nevada and Arizona and Florida. And then pretty much any place with a significant manufacturing sector. So that's not only Michigan and Ohio and Indiana, but it actually extends down into the South. And we see big job losses in Tennessee and Georgia and Alabama as well. Those are really the worst off places in the country right now.
So what is the extent to which this number shows that it's a moving target for big companies like General Motors, even General Electric, who are trying to get a sense of what the economic reality is and then project forward whether they're going to be bankrupt or not? I mean, whether you're a bank or an automaker or a retailer, these kinds of numbers really say your demand is going south very, very quickly, and that's going to mean more layoffs, a more reduction in business activity, and more of a sign that maybe a lot of these businesses aren't going to be coming back at all.
Yeah, that's right. And I think we will see, in particularly vulnerable industries, the auto industry. Not only that, but also an industry that's obviously close to my heart, which is newspapers. We've seen the Rocky Mountain News go under, and we're going to see more go under. And so we certainly will see businesses like that go under. And I do think we're now really gripped in this psychology of fear. And a lot of times when people talk about, well, how much is this recession just psychology? The implication is that, well, if only we could get our heads screwed on straight, everything would be fine. And this recession is a lot psychology, but it's not entirely irrational. The fact is that we did overspend for a long time. And so it's not irrational for businesses to be fearful that consumers are going to be spending less going forward. The key is to stop this really vicious cycle. And there's only one entity that can do that, and that's the government. And so that's the importance of, first, the stimulus package, but even more so, I think, is the financial rescue, to get the credit markets working again. Because while it's true that these things feed on themselves, every previous recession has always ended. So there's a point at which they stop feeding on themselves, and we need to try to get to that point, and we're not there yet.
David, you know, I hate to put you on the spot here, but you just mentioned that the Rocky Mountain News went out of business, and that businesses like that may go away. That isn't what people around the New York Times are saying, are they, about the Times?
Oh, no. No, I mean, I don't want to speak for every single person.
Right.
We have 1,300 people, but no, I mean, we obviously have a challenging situation in terms of making the transition from a print product to the web, and I don't at all want to understate the difficulty of that because the business model is very different. Advertisers just pay less online. But we are very fortunate, and we think about this every day, or at least I do. We have this enormous web audience. We have more people reading our journalism than ever have before. And so that gives us
a brand, an audience, eyeballs, visibility. We're all trying to make our way through this economic weeds.
And a
right
number
now.
Of opportunities to figure out
Indeed.
The business model, which, again, we haven't done yet.
All right. Well, David Leonhardt, thanks so much for, we share your pain. David Leonhardt writes the Economic Scene column every Wednesday in the New York Times. We're all navigating through this recession, 8.1% unemployment. Thank you, David.
Thanks, John.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. With these economic numbers, my recommendation, just escape. Go to the movies. See Watchmen. It envisions a world where Richard Nixon never left office.
Hi, this is Emily, and I'm calling from Bergen County, New Jersey. If President Nixon would have never left office, we would have never had the movie Forrest Gump. life is a box of chocolates.
That's a good thing. Forrest Gump met Richard Nixon in that movie. Forrest inadvertently triggers the Watergate scandal, you may remember. What forks in the road would you love to go back to change the course of history, cinematic or otherwise? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Well, thanks, John. This is Farai Chidea sitting in for Adora Udoji, who is on maternity leave. The global economic crisis seems to abide by an old rule. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. China is no exception. Yesterday, in a speech to China's Congress, Prime Minister Wen Jiabao said that 2009 may be the most difficult year for China's economic growth in the past decade. We've got Mark Williams, a China economy expert from Capital Economics, to help explain the situation. Mark, what kind of economic trouble is the Chinese Prime Minister actually talking about?
Well, of course, China is an economy that's used to growing extremely rapidly. Over the last 30 years since it started to open up, GDP growth has averaged around 10% each year. And as recently as 2007, the economy was growing by something like 13%. But that has all come to a crashing end. By the end of last year, the economy was growing by just 6.8%, and the more recent figures suggest that growth has slowed even further. So, I mean, these growth numbers, these slowing growth numbers are a shock in themselves. But from the point of view of Wen Jiabao and the Chinese government, perhaps a bigger concern is what this implies for what's happening to employment. Because, of course, the parts of the Chinese economy that have been hit hardest in this downturn are the export sector, which is a big employer of migrant workers, and also the construction sector, which is another big employer. So as bad as the GDP numbers are, I think that their big concern is what's happening to the jobless numbers.
What's the solution to a situation like this, which is so clearly intertwined with the U.S. economy, the EU economy, the entire world economy?
Well, China has some advantages. For one thing, it doesn't have the financial sector problems that that are really holding us back in the developed economies. But as elsewhere, China really is in search of extra demand for its output. And so the solution, in a sense, is fairly simple, of just boosting demand. They've come up with new spending packages. They've made a big deal of talking about their fiscal stimulus. The problem, though, is that for China, a large part of its growth over the last few years has been driven by investment and exports. And a lot of that investment was in the export sector on the idea that these factories would ultimately be able to ship their goods to the rest of the world. And so although China may be able to, over the next few months, by increasing its own spending, may be able to boost demand within China, it really needs to find a new way to support its growth in the years ahead, because it's going to be a fair while, I think, before demand growth from the developed world picks up back to the sort of rates we've seen in the last few years.
This demand issue, Mark Williams, is a bit of a devil, though, that you've raised, and it's a political devil. I mean, with a billion people, China, as you have mentioned, does have some options in spurring demand within its own borders. But some commentators have remarked that having an export-driven economy means it's much easier for the government to kind of control the manifestations of wealth in a growing place like China, and that once you shift to build demand more in the villages, in the cities, away from a sort of centralized export-driven economy, you also potentially breed political instability, the aspirations of people in various places in China. China could fuel a political instability, and with 26 million unemployed, that's a pretty potent brew.
I would rather argue that the opposite is the case. If you look at, in China at the moment, those who've done best out of the boom of the last few years, the middle classes, are among those that are most supportive of the current regime, of the Communist Party. They have no reason to want things to change. They've done extremely well. If this downturn does worsen, and if it lasts for a lot longer, then we're going to see a lot of discontent in the countryside amongst the migrants who have been sent back to the countryside, amongst young people who can't find work. So I think that's a bigger threat to the Chinese Communist Party than would be trying to increase incomes in rural communities, among poor households, trying to boost their consumption, which will help the economy grow much faster in the years ahead.
When you think about China's problems, are they going to boomerang on the U.S. directly? Will there be any direct effects? We're, you know, up to our waist in our own issues, but What about the question of, you know, I mean, there's still a lot of demand for cheaper goods. People may not be buying now, but you know, is this going to mitigate?
Well, there was some hope earlier on. A few months ago, people were hoping that China, because after all, China is still growing. It's one of the very few decent-sized economies that is growing at all, and it's still growing by maybe 5-7% at the moment. So, from a Western point of view, that's pretty good. However, I think it's too late now to hope that Chinese demand will provide much of a support for the rest of the world. China doesn't import that much, certainly from the US. Doesn't import a great deal from Europe. It imports kind of capital goods from Germany. It imports obviously a lot of commodities.
Mark, I've just quickly before we go, some commentators have suggested that political instability is much more likely at growth below 8%, and that above 8%, China's government is pretty safe. Do you buy that very quickly?
The 8% number, I don't put a lot of weight on. What really matters is what's happening to unemployment. If they can structure their growth so that it's better for jobs, then that will be better for overall stability.
All right, that was Mark Williams, China economy expert from Capital Economics. Thanks, Mark. And we've got Femi Oke with the news.
Thanks, Farai. Just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. Still staying with economic news, the Labor Department reports that the nation's unemployment rate went up to 8.1% in February. That's the highest it's been since 1983. Employers cut a total 651,000 jobs. A bill that provides mortgage relief to homeowners is moving on to the Senate. The bill passed the House last night. Members voted mainly on party lines. Now, if passed, the legislation would give bankruptcy judges power to reduce interest rates for some homeowners. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki says the country should forgive and reconcile with those who collaborated with Saddam Hussein's regime. The call comes ahead of coming national elections. Hussein's regime was mainly Sunni Muslim. Al-Maliki is a Shiite who fled Iraq under Hussein. And that's a look at some big stories in making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Farai Chidea. So what would the world look like if Nixon had never left office?
Hi, my name is Kristen. I'm calling from South Carolina. I was born after the Nixon administration, but my two cents would be no, things wouldn't be different, because no matter who seems to be at the helm, there are always the unseen Wizard of Oz's behind the curtain running the show.
All right, what do you think would have happened today if a single point in history changed? What forks in the road would you love to go back to change the course of history? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
I think Kristen would love Watchmen, the movie that's out today that has Nixon remaining in office, I think. Well, it's almost impossible to imagine 20th century history without Mahatma Gandhi, and some of his memorabilia was actually auctioned off yesterday. And what was the big deal?
I never intended for my actions to cause such a controversy, and I pray the outcome is positive and one that Gandhi would have approved of.
Well, someone answered James Otis's prayers. He's the owner of Gandhi Memorabilia, and he was speaking yesterday about an auction that caused international controversy. The eyeglasses, leather sandals, and Gandhi's dinner bowl bought a price of $1.8 million in a controversial New York auction yesterday. Covering that story is the New York Times' Jennifer Ait Lee, who's here in the studio with us. Now, this was a complicated affair, some very high rollers looking at some very small objects about a man known for nonviolence and, shall we say, an ascetic lifestyle, and not known for having lots of wealth. This was a clash of contradictions like I've never seen. First of all, what was the controversy?
Well, basically, there was a lot of uproar from the Indian media and India itself that protested the right of James Otis to sell these items in auction, and in a way sort of echoed some protests that were made by the Chinese government last month in the auctioning of bronze animal heads in a Parisian auction. So basically, the idea was, you know, did he have the right to have these belongings that they consider part of their cultural legacy because it belonged to a man they considered a spiritual and political leader of Indian independence? And so...
So that the idea that there even was a collector was offensive to the Indians and that they might actually fall out of the hands of India as a result of this auction was the fear.
Right. And they basically believe that, you know, these objects rightfully belonged to India. And to a large extent, you know, the Indian government took both political, diplomatic, and legal sort of lengths to intervene. For example, a high court in Delhi actually issued an injunction on Tuesday at the request of sort of the legal heirs of Gandhi to stop this auction. But as the auction house, which is called Antiquorum and Auctioneers in Manhattan, said, that sort of legal ruling doesn't have jurisdiction in the United States.
And boom, they conducted the auction anyway.
Yeah,
and Vijay Mallya, who's a brewery magnate in India, was identified as the buyer for $1.8 million. It seems like a couple of prayers were answered. If Otis was looking for some big money, he got it, and the objects are going to stay in India, it appears.
Yeah, it's interesting for two reasons. One, which is you actually had this auction attract a lot of sort of the who's who of the Indian elite around the world, and you kind of got into a situation where they were bidding against each other. And as a result, you know, it kind of was who is going to bid the most for the right to return it to India. And then so the Indian government itself also got caught in this ironic situation was because originally they said, you know, if you don't make a deal with us, Mr. Otis, we're going to be in the audience bidding. But then they realized that they themselves had deemed the auction illegal, so they could not participate. And so basically they were dependent on these third parties to sort of auction and then give it back. And so the sort of interesting historical sweep is that, in a way, the muscular wealth of the Indian elite trumped traditional diplomacy in sort of combating sort of the history and legacy of or the painful memories of subjugation to the West. And so basically something else that you found was Mr. Otis himself, as you heard, had last minute misgivings, but because the auction house basically said, you know, we have the right to, once you enter into a legal contract, you basically have to kind of go through with the auction, which is different from a 2007 case where a letter written by Gandhi shortly before he died was actually pulled from auction with the permission of Christie's.
I just wanted to quickly reference another recent case where there was a auction of designer Yves Saint Laurent's art collection, and some bidders bought two Chinese bronzes that were said to be looted and basically got a lot of media attention for that. So is this idea of cultural repatriation gaining steam?
Well, it's the situation you're talking about, there have been a lot of comparisons, but there are two things. One, which, as you mentioned, that these were actually looted from a Chinese the Yuanmingyuan, which is as a big historical garden by the West, whereas a lot of these items were given away by Gandhi himself. So, you know, the glasses were given away as sort of a symbol of things, as a way what he saw the freedom of India through. The sandals were given away. So, in a way, these kinds of things had gotten to Mr. Otis legitimately over time, and it just sort
their
of
provenance was known and it didn't have the sort of colonialist tinge. But here's something Gandhi, speaking of ironies of all this and the historical sweep that you talked about, Jennifer. Here's what Gandhi said back in 1931.
There is an unalterable law governing everything and every being that exists or lives. It is not a blind law, for no blind law can govern the conduct of living beings.
Without any offense to the legendary Mahatma Gandhi, but perhaps one unalterable law here is that money in the 21st century comes from South Asia, and it trumps all questions of national politics, at least if this auction is any indication.
Indeed. I mean, I think what was lucky for the Indian government is that they actually had the wealth. They had people with a national pride who were actually willing to compete. And in a way, the people who benefited was almost the auction house, right? Because they take the higher commission, the higher the item sells for.
Money talks. Fascinating story with a happy ending. Sold to Jennifer Eightley, who's in our studio covering the auction of some Gandhi memorabilia. Pulled in $1.8 million at auction last night. And now Femi Oke has the headlines.
Thanks, John. The time is just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. The nation's unemployment rate shot up 8.1% last month. Employers cut 651,000 more jobs. Also, the numbers of workers forced to work part-time rose by 787,000. So that means some 8.6 million Americans are working but getting fewer hours than they want, and that's all down to the economy. The United Nations says it will investigate whether Sudan's decision to expel humanitarian groups is a war crime. The Sudanese government ordered 13 of the largest aid organizations to leave after the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for President Omar al-Bashir, who's accused of crimes involving the Darfur region. The United Nations says that kicking aid groups out puts lives at risk. The Air Force is beginning special inspections for hundreds of its C-130 transport planes. The large aircrafts are workhorses for the US military. They're used to carry troops, equipment and supplies around the world. Cracks were found on bolts that hold the wings on during routine maintenance of one plane. The inspection only involves older models that were built before 1999. That's a look at stories making headlines this morning.
Keeping your wings bolted on is pretty important, I guess, if you're flying, right?
Essential.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea.
What this is impossible. I mean, a man loses an eye. Who can make him a new eye to see out of?
All right, that's from a film made by a man with one eye who's doing what the $6 million man said was impossible. Rob Spence is making a statement about surveillance by making a film about it, but he's going further by putting a surveillance camera in his eye socket. No, he's not taking one out. He lost one when he was a teen. Rob's with us. Now, you say you wanted to be a superhero to deal with this. How so?
You know, I think we all want to be superheroes in a way. And when you're a one-eyed filmmaker and you have a chance to stick some high technology in your body and make an entertaining film, why not become a superhero fighting for justice? That's precisely what I'm trying to do.
You say when you have the chance to stick some high technology in your body, explain exactly what you mean.
I have one eye. So I have this eye socket that's got a prosthetic eye in it. And when you're a filmmaker, you're looking at your prosthetic eye. Sometimes you can just pull it out and take a look at it, which is weird because you're looking at yourself in a way. And so if you have your cell phone in your other hand, you could just look at how big the cameras are now. They're called camera modules, and I've talked to a lot of those companies. There's definitely off-the-shelf technology that I can put inside a prosthetic eye and have a camera right there in my head.
That is sort of like a Terminator. I can just remember when Schwarzenegger kind of cut his flesh off of his eye socket. I'm getting geeky again. So how do people feel about...
We can totally do that, too. I'm not going to put a red light in my
eye
or a red laser. I'm going to put a blue one because that's the good guys. This is the option that I actually have. Like, I can stick a light in there, and some guys are giving me a hard time in a bar, let's say, and I'll just activate the little switch that'll turn on the blue light, and I'll say, please, you don't know who you're dealing with here, that sort of thing.
Mechanically, do you have a remote control? How do you deal with this? Where are the mechanics?
We're at the prototype stage right now, so it's a bit crude, and I have no budget for the project right now, though I am looking for a budget. I think we need about $50,000 to do a really good working version of the eye that I can actually use to help me make my film.
You'll make the film of you shooting the world through your eye.
Yes, in part. I think it might be too much to ask people to watch an entire film from an eye's point of view with the blinking and the glancing around. But definitely a part of the film and fleeting sort of important moments and the direct eye contact and the frank conversations you have with people, the conversations you can have with people without them knowing that you're having conversations with them, and very natural conversations, are something that, as a documentary filmmaker, I'm very interested in.
Well, speaking of direct eye contact, we've linked to your video, which is a fairly blunt and grim sort of exploration of exactly what you're doing. So I wanted to remind people of that. It's on our website at The Takeaway.
It is a bit blunt and grim, but there's also me doing a parody of The Bionic Man in there. So it's not too blunt and grim. I would hold on to your croissants, if you know what I mean. There's footage of the eye getting removed.
Okay, well, I look forward to seeing this, I think. Sure. My guest was Canadian filmmaker Rob Spence. You can check him out now at iborgblog.com.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. The hard policy and the soft, touchy-feely rhetoric of health care reform under the Obama administration in a moment. Right after headlines from Femi, okay.
Thanks, John. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. A plan to give debt-strapped homeowners a chance to lower their mortgage payments in bankruptcy court faces a much tougher road in the Senate. It passed in the House in modified form, but faces even more mortgage industry opposition and reservations also from moderate Democrats. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is meeting with her Russian counterpart today in Geneva. One of her goals is putting U.S.-Russia relations back on track.
There are areas where we just flat out disagree, and we're not going to paper those over. We will not recognize the breakaway areas of Georgia. We do not recognize any sphere of influence on the part of Russia, and they're having some kind of veto power over who can join the EU or who can join NATO. So, yes, we run the gamut.
But there will be several proposals where Clinton hopes there will be agreement, including an appeal for help in stopping Iran's nuclear program, as well as accelerated arms control talks. The actor Matt Damon is appealing for help for thousands of Zimbabwean refugees living on the border with South Africa. Despite a new coalition government, people are still leaving to escape the harsh conditions at home. Damon toured one of the biggest refugee camps and was obviously moved by the people he met.
You know, I spoke to one woman who was incredibly happy, and she was holding her asylum paper. She'd been granted asylum in South Africa. And I said, pardon me for asking this, but every woman I've talked to has been raped, you know, and were you raped? And she said, oh, yes, I was raped, but they didn't take my dignity.
Matt Damon was visiting Southern Africa for the human rights organization Not On Our Watch. That's a look at headlines making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So there was a healthcare summit in Washington yesterday. It was a kind of a touchy-feely moment if you watched it. Is it governance by kumbaya moment? President Obama had a healthcare summit in Washington yesterday. The meeting was attended by lawmakers, doctors, and seven average Americans who claimed they were going to roll up their sleeves and get to work reforming healthcare in the United States. It was a major issue in the presidential campaign. And with all of the crisis in the economy, getting to healthcare seems to be third, fourth, or fifth on the list of priorities in America. But to Dr. Marcia Angel, who's senior lecturer in social medicine at Harvard Medical School and former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, perhaps it's it's job one in the United States. And Dr. Angel, first of all, I'm very thrilled to have you on the program. It's nice to talk to you again.
Well, good morning. It's great to be here.
And let's take a look at that kind of touchy-feely moment at the healthcare summit in Washington. You see a lot of the same characters back in play who were part of the Clinton healthcare initiative.
You certainly do.
but they sound a lot older and more in need of healthcare in some cases. What do you make of this approach to healthcare? It seems very open-ended as opposed to very specific on the part of the Clintons. And it seems as though cost is not part of the debate in the early going.
Well, I think it was. I mean, that was the one high point for me of yesterday's summit. Everyone seemed to agree with the president that cost is the central issue, that without containing costs and containing their rapid rise, any reform is useless. So I think that was helpful. We didn't hear that 15 years ago. But other than that, it was, as you say, a kumbaya moment. It was politics, not policy, a lot of nice rhetoric, a lot of people pleading for their special interests. The fight hasn't begun, but it will. You can count on that.
Now, it does seem as though cost is off the table in the sense that Obama has said we got $637 billion. That's what it's going to be. And so cost containment over 10 years, right. And cost containment comes out of getting whatever program they come up with to fit. There was a lot of talk yesterday about if we don't get everything, that shouldn't keep us from getting something. Where do you think the key compromise thresholds are going to be?
Well, you really can't compromise in the sense that anything you do to expand coverage, and Obama is committed to that, will inevitably increase costs unless you change the system entirely. And as you suggest, the same old characters were there. There isn't any real sense of an overhaul of the system, just tinkering around the edges. So anything you do to increase coverage will increase costs, and anything you do to control costs will decrease coverage. Those two things have to move in parallel. And the president doesn't seem to really be willing to accept that yet. He's looking for some magic bullet that will allow him both to increase coverage and decrease costs. And there is no such bullet if you don't change the system entirely.
This is Farai, and it strikes me that there is a cascade effect that could happen with all the people becoming unemployed. Even people who want to keep coverage, some of them are saying, you know what, I'm going to roll the dice. I'm going to become uninsured. Other people downgrade their plans, and they find themselves having, frankly, you know, enormous deductibles. I know someone who rolled the dice on a lower plan, and then his son broke his leg, and it was $1,400 out of pocket. What do you think the ramifications will be overall?
That's a very good point. One big difference this time from the last time in 1993 is that business is hurting. You can just kiss employer-based insurance goodbye, really, as you point out. I mean, there may be insurance in the sense that on paper they have insurance, but it's insurance they can't afford to use because the deductibles and co-payments are so high, or else the package is too skimpy to really be useful. So we are seeing business pull out of this health care industry.
And that's also been going on. Let's stop there for a moment, because that's an enormously significant trend, and Farai has identified it. The question really is, does this economic downturn provide an opportunity to really revamp the incentive structure in healthcare so that we don't have the profit incentives for big pharma or the profit incentives for managed care like we've traditionally had, which so derailed the 93 plans?
Well, that's my hope. I'm not all that optimistic. I think the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry has not yet begun to fight. They're talking nicely now, but they're not going to keep that up. But it would be my hope, because I think for the first time, other American industries are seeing that these two giant industries are bleeding them, that they can't afford to compete globally because so much of their revenues are going out the back door for health care. So the business community, which in 1993, for ideological reasons, sided with the health insurance industry, now they're splitting off. Now they're saying, look, we can't afford this anymore.
So it's a bailout. They're looking for a bailout, and we've already got bailouts going. A health care bailout wouldn't be so radical.
Right. Now, but you just touched on the major problem, which is that we are the only advanced country in the world that has left health care to a profit-driven system. We treat health care like a market commodity, which we distribute according to the ability to pay and not according to medical need. And we leave it to investor-owned insurance companies and largely for-profit health facilities. This is extremely wasteful. It drives up costs. So we spend over twice as much per person for health care as other advanced countries. It makes no sense.
Well, bad numbers going into a debate that's certainly going to get more heated as we proceed. Thanks for giving us some data there out of the kumbaya moment in Washington on health care. Dr. Marcia Angel is a senior lecturer of social medicine at Harvard Medical School and former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine.
Well, the Watchman envisions a world where Nixon never left office. What do you think would have happened today if Nixon had stayed? Would Tylenol be included in the war on drugs?
Hey, this is Mike from Pawleys Island, South Carolina. I'd like to see Archduke Ferdinand, instead of being assassinated, he was alive, and then we would not have had World War I and World War II.
That's a great one.
Yeah, definitely. Austrian's Archduke Franz Ferdinand, not the band, and his wife Sophie were shot dead on June 28, 1914, sparking World War I, which then, of course, rolled over into the resentment that sparked World War II.
You are such a hipster.
I'm sorry. It's hipster nerd. DJ African tweeted us to say the Reagan and Bush, both of them years, were a continuance of the Nixon years. Nixon's people served in those administrations.
That's a good point. That's a good
Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org or on our Twitter feed. And here's your takeaway.
It's really tricky to read too much into a single month's trend, but on the other hand, an hour after the unemployment numbers have come out, we don't really have any choice.
That's David Leonhardt talking about those unemployment numbers that came out an hour and a half ago. He writes the economic scene column every Wednesday in the New York Times. Those jobless numbers worse than expected, 8.1% in February, highest level in more than 25 years, payroll losing 651,000 workers. Go to thetakeaway.org. For more, I'm Farai Chidea.
That's a week of The Takeaway, Farai. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Congratulations.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.